And everyone, this is episode 5 of the Secular Foxhole Podcast. I'm Blair, I'm with Martin, and we have a special guest today. Ben Bayer is a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, and he's an instructor. He teaches in the Objectivist Academic Center, lectures and gives interviews for the Ayn Rand Institute. He also writes and edits for ARI's online publication, New Ideal. Dr. Bayer holds a PhD in philosophy, and his writing focuses primarily on the application of philosophy to contemporary cultural and political controversies. So you're quite busy, I bet.
Yeah, I find time to do a lot of things. Thanks for having me, Blair and Martin.
Yeah.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Welcome. Believe us, it's our pleasure. Go ahead, Martin.
And I have to add, in the long, nice bio there on the Institute site, you had a mention there, previous works at the Undercurrent. Could you tell a little bit about that, Ben? Because I valued that very much, how you did on the campus clubs and so on, and spreading good words.
Yeah, this is a student publication that I helped to found back in... I think it was 2004 or 5 with Ray Gurn and a number of other people who are now active in various different objectivist circles. But it was, we put it out, I guess, 2 to 4 times a year. And depending on how busy we were at the time, a lot of us, I think, started to develop our writing chops working for that student publication, and have gone on to do other kinds of intellectual careers. In my case, I'm now writing professionally for the Ayn Rand Institute. So it's the way a lot of us got started.
Great. And I must say this, because I remember how I distributed with the fellow objectivist at the business universities and other places in Gothenburg, Sweden. And we read it, and so I thought it was a great publication, and a bit of, you could call it almost like a grassroots magazine.
Yeah, I wish there were more students today who wanted to do the same kind of thing. I'd love to support their efforts. So if anyone out there wants to do it again, let me know.
It's needed, I think. So yeah, continue.
I was about to ask if the Undercurrent still publishing, but I haven't seen it in a while.
I don't think they're still publishing. The entity that they're a part of, Strive, is still in existence, but I think...
That's right. Okay. Well, Ben, in our correspondence, I had mentioned a couple essays that for us to explore, and you came back with one from her nonfiction work, The Virtue of Selfishness, called The Ethics of Emergencies. And I thought that's an excellent one to get started with. Can you give a brief bio of that chapter or that essay?
Sure. So this is an essay that I picked because I think there's a lot in it that is, first of all, relevant to a lot of work that I'm doing currently in ethics. I think it's relevant to a lot of things that people debate about in ethics these days. And I think there's a lot in this essay that's underappreciated even by objectivists. And I came up with a very pithy way of introducing to you the topic of the essay, because there's an online index called the Philosopher's Index. It used to be in print form. And there was a time back in the 1960s when the late Alan Gotthelf, eminent objectivist philosopher, actually went through all of Ayn Rand's published articles at the time and wrote up abstracts for each of them and sent them off to the Philosopher's Index, and they were published there. And so here, let me read to you Alan Gotthelf's summary of this article. Applying the fundamentals of the author's objectivist ethics to the sphere of human relationships, this article defines moral principles governing non-sacrificial help to others with special attention to emergency situations. I think it's a very good summary of what this article is all about. And there's a lot more to say, of course. That's just the high-level abstract.
I agree. Yeah, that was a very good summary. One of the things that struck me, of course, I reread the essay and formulated some questions for you about it. One of the things I'll mention is I was in a conversation. This is years ago. I was in a conversation with a good coworker, a good friend and coworker of mine at the time, and I was trying to describe or explain how getting drunk, if you will, and getting behind the wheel of your car and injuring someone, or worse, was not an act of selfishness, but an act of selflessness. And she just looked at me with this blank stare. And but the same person, years later, went on to read Atlas Shrugged, and now is very, very enthusiastic about Ayn Rand. But anyway, at the time, she just she didn't get it.
Yeah, and this is an essay which I think has a lot to say about that issue. And you wouldn't guess it maybe from the title, The Ethics of Emergencies. But you know, one issue is that the essay isn't really about emergencies. It's about, like the description suggested, it's about how the author's objectivist ethics, how her view of the virtue of selfishness applies to the sphere of human relationships and defines why a rationally selfish person would want to offer non-sacrificial help to other people. This is something that comes up in connection with emergencies, because many of the emergency sorts of scenarios that philosophers debate about involve, would you help someone who's drowning or who's trapped in a fire, stepping in front of a speeding truck? These are the examples mentioned at the beginning of the essay. These involve helping other people. And one of the things that she wants to clarify in this essay is that there can be rationally selfish reasons to help other people, that we can take interest in the interests of other people. And so that's then related to the scenario that you were talking about, Blair, because, I mean, obviously, if there can be rationally selfish reasons to help other people, there are definitely then also rationally selfish reasons to not want to hurt other people, as in the case of, you know, taking risks with the lives of others when you're drunk driving or something like that.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I concur. One of the things that struck me also about the essay, in my youth, I grew up in the Midwest in the 60s, and there was just a general air of benevolence and goodwill. I had a paper route, and I had about 150 people, and everyone, you know, they were always kind and generous and hello, and they always greeted me and gave me tips and so on and so forth. And I think that's waning today because of the influx or the overwhelming saturation of altruism.
Yeah, a couple things to say about that. I mean, one is that the bulk of what this essay is about is what are rationally selfish reasons for sometimes wanting to help other people. Major contrasting view of that she's opposing is the altruistic view that the only reason you would ever want to help another person is out of a sense of selfless duty. And she's very much concerned with pushing back against that. And one of the points that she makes to support her thesis is that when people are told that the only reason you could ever have for helping another person is out of selfless duty, you come to think that other people are not aspects of your own self-interest, that other people are burdens on you, that they only call for you to sacrifice. And yeah, if you think of other people that way, then you won't have goodwill toward them. You'll only feel a sense of fear or guilt in relation to other people. And one point that I think is worth making to underscore just how important other people can be to our interests to further push back against the altruistic implication is, I mean, think about the way many of us are living today because of this pandemic. We've had to socially isolate ourselves. We've had to socially distance. And to put it crudely, it sucks. I mean, if anybody thinks their life is better off because they are isolated from others, because they can't go out and see their friends, because they've lost a job that's been offered by other people, because they've lost loved ones who've actually died because of the disease, they're crazy if they think they're better off because they're isolated from people in this way. No, I mean, the fact that we've had to isolate ourselves from others in one way or another, I think really demonstrates that other people are a really essential ingredient in our happiness and our flourishing. And, you know, when they're removed from us, our lives are made worse for it.
Agreed. Yes, I agree. That brings up, you know, again, I experienced that, you know, when I walk my dog. So some people, you know, they'll walk across the street or others, and others will just say, can I join you and walk with you for a while? You know? So you can see that happening on an individual level in your own neighborhood. Yes. Another thing that struck me, again, she is such a brilliant writer. It's staggering sometimes to think about what she accomplished. Her ethics obviously are set apart from what, two millennia of the dominant altruist code. To me, she's revolutionized and redefined the field of ethics. What do you think about that?
Well, I would say yes, in large part, especially if you compare her views to the last, let's say, 500 years of ethics. But there are things in this essay and things in her ethical viewpoint more generally that are not revolutionary if, let's say, you compare what she's doing to what the ancient Greeks were doing, especially to Aristotle.
Sure. And,
you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about this essay is that she points out right at the very beginning that if you think of ethics as concerned significantly with the kinds of questions about what to do in emergencies where somebody else is about to lose their life and you have to engage in risky behavior in order to save them, and that's where we're going to get our understanding of ethics from, then there's going to be certain consequences in the way you think about ethics. You're going to think that the first, I'm quoting from the very first page. She says, if you accept ethics, then one, you'll get a lack of self-esteem, since his first concern in the realm of values is not how to live his life, but how to sacrifice it. Two, lack of respect for others, since he regards mankind as a herd of doomed beggars crying for someone's help. And then skipping a little bit, especially importantly, number four, and in fact, a lethargic indifference to ethics, a hopelessly cynical amorality, since his questions involve situations which he is not likely ever to encounter, which bear no relation to the actual problems of his own life, and thus leave him to live without any moral principles, whatever. One of the things that I think this essay does a good job stressing and emphasizing is that the problem with focusing on these emergency situations is not that emergencies never happen, and it's not that ethics has nothing to say about emergencies. It's that the kind of situations that you're dealing with in emergencies are not representative of the basic reason that we need ethics. Ethics isn't about making very narrow decisions about imminent threats to your life, let's say. It's about making big picture decisions. It's about offering guidance for your life as a whole in the long range, where, of course, there is no long range to speak of when you're dealing with an emergency. Ethics is about normal life. It's about what kind of life do you want to live? What kind of person do you want to be? And so when altruism says, no, ethics is all about sacrifice, it's all about when people's lives are apparently in conflict with each other as in emergency situations. Well, the fact is that most of life isn't actually like that. And so ethics, an altruistic ethics, doesn't have any guidance for the rest of life. This is something that, and you know, and Ayn Rand's view is, no, ethics does have a lot of guidance for the rest of your life. This is something that she agreed with the ancient Greek philosophers about, such as Aristotle. Aristotle's ethics isn't about emergency situations either. It's about what it is to acquire an excellent character. And Rand's view is similar, though she has, I think, deeper things to say about what an excellent character means.
I certainly didn't mean to leave Aristotle out of my summation a moment ago. But
sure.
Yes, I agree with that, Ben. That's very succinct. And again, going back to today's teaching of ethics, this lifeboat scenario thing, it drives me crazy. It's okay, there's room for seven and there's nine of you. So who decides which two of you, you know, get tossed overboard or whatever? That kind of thing. Again, it doesn't apply to your everyday life.
That's right. And one of the interesting things is this. So this essay was written in 1963, originally in the Objectivist newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a way prophetic, because I don't know exactly how lifeboat scenarios were being discussed in 1963 among philosophers, but shortly thereafter, in I think it was 1972, a philosopher by the name of Peter Singer published a famous essay, now famous essay, called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. And Peter Singer is now very famous today because of that essay. The basic argument that he makes in the essay, it's as if it could have come right out of the ethics of emergencies. And where he goes with it is exactly where she would have predicted a philosopher to go with it. Singer has this famous example where he says, imagine you're walking by a pool and you see a child drowning in the pool. And you'll get your pants wet if you go and save the child. Would you do it? Well, of course you would go and save the child if it were a simple thing for you to do. Well, but then by the same token, if you find out that there are starving children around the world and you can save them by giving money, well, there's no reason to privilege the child who you see in the pool just because he's near you. Wouldn't you therefore think you should also help out all the starving children around the world who are in effect also drowning in pools just by giving up some money? And in fact, there are a lot of these starving children in the world. And so shouldn't you try to work to save all of them? And so this turns into what has now become a whole movement in ethics called the effective altruist movement, where what people do is they figure out the way to make the most money as they can so that they can then give away as much of it as they can to the most effective charities around the world so that they can save lots of children from, in effect, drowning. And I mean, this is exactly the kind of argument that she's talking about when she says that it's proper to help even strangers when it's an emergency, but that it's different when you're dealing with non-emergency situations, when you're dealing with people who are facing trouble through the predictable problems of existence. And here I'll read to you the paragraph which is really relevant to Singer, because she says, it's only in emergency situations that one should volunteer to help strangers if it is in one's power. For instance, a man who values human life and is caught in a shipwreck should help to save his fellow passengers, though not at the expense of his own life. But this does not mean that after they all reach shore, he should devote his efforts to saving his fellow passengers from poverty, ignorance, neurosis, or whatever other troubles they might have. Nor does it mean that he should spend his life sailing the seven seas in search of shipwrecked victims to save. And that's exactly what Singer is basically advocating, and what now a whole movement of people are advocating. And sometimes, you know, Ayn Rand is criticized for using what that people say is a kind of straw man argument against altruism, which is to say she's kind of exaggerating what altruism really asks people to do. Well, Peter Singer has now started a global movement of people in effect, going around searching the seven seas in search of shipwrecked victims. That's not a straw man.
Yeah, no, it isn't. And sadly, he's more popular than she is still. Anyway, that does, when we go deeper, though, into ethics, one of the things that in the essay she talks about, she uses the word integrity. How does your personal integrity blend into an ethics? Especially, well, how does it blend into ethics, personal integrity?
Well, it comes up in this essay because she's talking about what somebody who values their relationships should be expected to do because of what they value. Integrity, the way she puts it, is loyalty to one's convictions and values, the policy of acting in accordance with one's values, of expressing, upholding, and translating them into practical reality. And so the idea is, if you really, if someone's your friend, if someone's your loved one, then that's not a casual thing. You're committed to that person, that you see them as a crucial element of your own life and happiness. And that means, I mean, a value is something you act to gain or keep. And so if you really value them, you act to keep them and to help them and to protect them when they're in trouble. And you'll do it even if it means taking risks, in part on because of the premise that if they really are as important to you as you think, then you think your life wouldn't be worth so much if they were to die. And so you're willing to take that risk. You're willing to, in effect, gamble. And this is, I think, another interesting way in which the whole approach that she has to ethics is different from the altruist approach. Because if you think about it, a virtue like integrity, which means loyalty to your principles, loyalty to your values, is not mm-hmm. even a, I mean, it's a virtue that a lot of people recognize as a kind of moral virtue. I mean, lots of non-objectivists see integrity as something admirable, morally speaking, but it really Agreed, doesn't yes. have much to do at all with altruism, right? Like, what's so important about your values and your cherished loved ones? You know, that altruists will sometimes ask people to sacrifice their integrity. If, you know, who cares about your little conscience? If you can, you know, you might feel guilty slaughtering millions of people, but if it helps even more millions of people, go ahead and do it. So integrity is a virtue that I think it's an interesting case because it's a case where lots of people realize it's a moral virtue, but you can only make sense of why it's a moral virtue if you reject altruism and embrace this ethical egoistic view of Rand's.
I agree. Yeah, related ben, would, to that. Go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, Ben, would you say that the benevolent universe principle, how is it standing nowadays? Since the 60s.
Okay, so you're now touching on an issue that comes up later in the essay, which I think is super interesting. She argues that the altruist ethics, now here I'll just quote the passage. She says, the altruist ethics is based on a malevolent universe metaphysics, on the theory that man, by his very nature, is helpless and doomed. Success, happiness, achievement are impossible to him, that emergencies, disasters, catastrophes are the norm of his life, and his primary goal is to combat them. So her view is that every ethical philosophy is based on a certain view of what she calls metaphysics, a view of the nature, the basic nature of reality. And one of the things that's interesting about people who think the way to understand ethics is to look at these lifeboat situations is, well, it's a way of saying we think reality kind of is an emergency all the time, which is to say we see reality as perilous. Life is perilous. We're always threatened. There's nothing that we can really do to live securely with any confidence. There's always some disaster coming around the corner, including other people. Other people are a threat to us. And so if we want to help them, we have to give something up. And it's interesting because you see this all over the place today. So you may have heard that that Pope Francis, the head of the Catholic Church, recently released a new papal encyclical. These are important documents because they express the Catholic Church's very fundamental philosophical viewpoints about life and existence. And the latest encyclical is called, I believe it's Tutti Fratelli, which means we're all brothers. So it's a kind of we're our brother's keeper kind of message. And it's fascinating to look at the way the Pope motivates his view that we're all brothers. He starts by drawing on what he thinks is really significant about the current pandemic. And here, let me quote from the very beginning of the encyclical. He says, "True, a worldwide tragedy like the COVID-19 pandemic momentarily revived the sense that we are a global community, all in the same boat, where one person's problems are the problems of all. Once more, we realize that no one is saved alone. We are only to be saved together. As I said in those days, the storm has exposed our vulnerability and uncovered those false and superfluous certainties around which we constructed our daily schedules, our projects, our habits, and priorities. Amid this storm, the facade of those stereotypes with which we camouflaged our egos, always worrying about appearances, has fallen away, revealing once more the ineluctable and blessed awareness that we are part of one another, that we are brothers and sisters of one another." So his whole idea is life is an emergency. We're all stuck in this lifeboat together. We're all living in a perilous existence, and so the only way we can get by is if we all think of each other as brothers and sisters and constantly sacrifice to each other. And then, of course, he draws all kinds of ethical and political conclusions from this, including that private property is superfluous, that there should basically be a kind of global collectivist state to, you know, force us all into one big family together. And I mean, he's repeating a lot of the same kinds of ideas that Ayn Rand critiqued in earlier papal encyclicals like Populorum Progressio in her essay, The Requiem for Man. But it's like updated for the age of COVID and now with all this really malevolent universe metaphysics in it as well. Like when you think, if you think that the religious ethics has some kind of sunny, optimistic view because there's the promise of heaven someday. Well, it's not sunny and optimistic about life on Earth, that's for sure.
True, true. This may or may not be straying a little bit away from the essay that we're talking about, but how do you see, I'll speak for myself when I say I think organized religion is fading, although there you still see, what is this, what's the term? Prosperity ethics or something like that. Like
prosperity gospel?
That's it. Thank you. What is your view on that? Or have you thought about that at any length?
I haven't taken a very close look at that viewpoint. But one thing that I would say about it is that it's a viewpoint that's characteristic of the sort of charismatic evangelical sects of Christianity, which are very uniquely American. You don't see them elsewhere in the world. So they're one thing that's characteristic of that sect is that they're highly emotionalistic and anti-intellectual. And so I think when you look at the most intellectual expressions of religion, especially Christianity, when you look at a thinker who tries to integrate all of the different pieces of Christian worldview, you're going to get that kind of malevolent universe view. The fact that the prosperity gospel tries to suggest that, you know, God wants you to be happy on earth and success is possible, you can only really do that if you're not trying to create an intellectual perspective, if it's kind of an emotionalistic take on religion that doesn't try to integrate all the different pieces. And so, I mean, these are people who are, you can only accept a viewpoint like that if you're operating on it very emotionally, if you're living in a kind of schizophrenic existence, trying to relate your ideas to the world. It's a way that people have tried to rationalize the, you know, a way to fit religion together with the American dream. And it's a rationalization. It's not really a philosophy. I mean, in a way, lots of philosophies are rationalizations as well, but it's an unstable viewpoint. And I think the more seriously people take religion, the harder it is to maintain that tempted optimism. Yeah.
Yes, you were back.
Well, I actually had a coughing fit, so I kind of muted my phone here.
That's okay.
Hope you're okay.
Well, yeah. I'll survive.
Drink tea or water, yeah. Don't set yourself up in an emergency. So.
You touched on this earlier, probably, but one of the questions I have, you know, is what is the proper attitude towards strangers? I mean, I've always looked at other people, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt and, you know, just being, I know that I'm a good person and I believe that they're good people until they prove me otherwise. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think benefit of the doubt is a good way to think about it. The way that Ayn Rand characterizes it at one point in the essay is to think of the value that they have to offer you as a potential, right? So if they're strangers, you don't really know who they are. You don't know what they have to offer. But unless you know otherwise, there's the potential for value there. She also talks about the issue of what she calls species solidarity, where you know that they're another being like you. And insofar as that's true, you have something in common with them. And
true.
Knowing that gives you a certain perspective. It's almost a kind of aesthetic perspective on their value, in just the same way that you get value from art when you see that it is expressing and embodying and concretizing your view of life. Well, the mere fact that somebody is another person, it's not quite on that same level, but there's a certain value in still seeing in concrete form, this is another person like me. This is someone facing the same challenges and the same having to make the same kind of decisions as I am. And all things being equal, I mean, you want to see them succeed because you identify with their position. You empathize with it.
Yes, I agree. Yes, yeah. Yeah, whenever I see someone, you know, have a new car or something, I don't get envious or anything. I just go, you know, I congratulate them as soon as I can see them. You know, I say, oh, that's a nice car. Great. Good for you. You know, I don't get wrapped up in like, oh, man, you know, how did they get that? That kind of thing. Martin, do you have any other questions or closing thoughts? Or
I'm thinking, Ben, you're, you know, academic, yeah, and studying and did this review of this essay, you could say. What do you have in future plans regarding your career and to light things up here in a positive way so we don't be in emergencies all the time? And also, follow-up thing is, who would you would like to listen to in the future?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'll say first something about part of the reason that I chose this essay is because it is, some of the themes in here are things related to things I'm working on. I mentioned
Do you care to share that? Or?
Yeah. I mentioned the Pope's encyclical. So actually, we're doing a podcast on New Ideal live just this coming week. Probably by the time you release the podcast, it'll already have happened, but it'll be about that encyclical. So we'll be talking about some of the very issues that came up in that quotation. of his. I also have an essay that has already been written that will be released on New Ideal Live. Sorry, just on New Ideal on the journal's website within the next 2 weeks, called Why Today's Morality Offers No Guidance. And it deals with this question of how academic ethics focuses on not just emergencies, but all kinds of weird special cases where there are conflicts between people's interests. And then what are you supposed to do to resolve these conflicts, and who's supposed to be sacrificed to whom? And so there was an article in a recent post on the blog of the American Philosophical Association where a non-objectivist philosopher noticed that, look, so many of the kind of cases that are studied in ethics textbooks are like this. And what does that tell us about the field of ethics? And he says, you know, maybe there's something wrong here, and that ethics should really be focused on kind of bigger picture questions. And so I point out that's a good observation. And I said, maybe it has something to do with the way that altruism conceives of the subject of ethics, and that for a way forward, you need to reject the idea that ethics is about sacrifice, that no, it's really about giving you guidance for living. So that'll be coming out in just a couple of weeks. And I also have an essay in the works about what objectivists call the frozen abstraction fallacy, and how that applies to the concept of ethics. This is the idea that just takes ethics as equivalent in meaning to altruism, and how that is an overly narrow view of what the concept of ethics even refers to. And I talk about reasons for thinking that it has to be broader than that, and that you have to consider an ethical form of egoism as another possibility that you should consider if you're thinking about what the right view of ethics is. Oh, and then one more thing is that something that we didn't get to talk about, but which I think is an example of the same issue in contemporary ethics, right along with lifeboat problems. Maybe you've heard of the trolley problem. There's a series of different scenarios that philosophers debate about where you're on a trolley that's careening towards some innocent victims who are stuck on a track, and you can derail the train, put it onto another track where it'll kill just one person instead of five. And there's a whole bunch of different variations on this that are used for different purposes. But it's the same of situation, and it's representative of the same approach to ethics that isn't concerned with coming up with life guidance generally. And I'm going to be probably writing an article about that at some point. But before I do it, I'll be teaching a unit of an OAC seminar later this spring on a book about the trolley problem for our third year students in our book seminar. It's a book by David Edmonds called Would You Kill the Fat Man? The Trolley Problem and What Your Answer Tells Us About Right and Wrong. It's a very interesting book insofar it lays out where this problem has come from, what philosophers do with it, what's problematic about the problem, and I'll be mining this for material for, I hope, a future article on the same subject that I'll write myself.
That's outstanding. Yeah, I'll have to check that book out myself. Yeah, I have stacks of books, but that's okay. You know, I think Martin mentioned that who else would you like to come on our show? I was thinking if I could, I have a correspondence with Aaron. I'm going to ask him in the future to come on. Do you think that would be good?
Yeah, he'll, I'm sure, have plenty to talk about on some parallel related issues. He's actually teaching another seminar also for the OAC Year 3 on modern Stoicism, which is interesting insofar as it is, as an ancient philosophy, Stoicism also is concerned with kind of bigger picture questions about how to guide your life. And so in that regard is a lot better than these modern focus on funny emergency situations. However, there's a lot of problems with the kind of advice that Stoic philosophy has to give, and in certain ways, it paves the road to altruism. And Aaron has thought a lot about that, so that could maybe something you talk about.
Yeah, I think great. That could be sounds very interesting because that have become pretty popular in popular culture and
yes.
in podcasting on podcasts and other things like that.
Yes.
So that could be great to hear his take on that. So thanks, Ben, for that.
Sure.
Our guest today has been Ben Bayer, a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, enlightening us on the proper role of ethics as opposed to just ethics for emergencies. Ben, thanks for manning the foxhole with us today.
Very welcome, though foxhole sounds a bit like an emergency too. So.
Yeah. Well, I don't mean yes. it to be that way.
No, I know I get it. Covers. I think in this day and age, it often feels like we are in an intellectual foxhole, in an intellectual battle.
Yes, mm-hmm. That is that was my purpose for naming it this, you know, the secular foxhole.
It's a great name and conversation starter. So talking about foxholes in the cyberspace, where are you located, Ben? Where could we find you and your work?
Well, I am, of course, a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute. And so if you go to newideal.aynrand.org, that is our online journal where I have, where I publish a number of my articles. And of course, the Ayn Rand Institute also has a YouTube channel and where I do a lot of our podcasts. I did one this past week. I'm doing another one, the one I mentioned about the Pope next week. That's on Wednesday, October 14th at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That's the time we meet every week.
Okay. Very cool. Very cool. You also, didn't you release an essay on, was it Real Clear Politics or something just the other day?
Yeah, that was on the topic of, that was a policy issue, but with some ethical aspects to it about the rapid antigen tests, which if are a cheap and relatively effective way of finding out whether you are contagious with the coronavirus, except that the FDA doesn't let us buy them. It doesn't let us use them as an over-the-counter product. And I mean, it's a good example of if we had these things, we wouldn't be in as much of an emergency as we're in now. Yeah. It would be a way of getting out and stopping from getting into the emergency in the first place.
Agencies are creating emergencies.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a way of resuming normal life if we could constantly, regularly test ourselves and isolate ourselves when we were infected and leaving everyone free to otherwise go about their business.
So they're already available, but we're not allowed to have them.
The technology is there. The companies are ready to make them, but they're not approved by the FDA. And only because it's true that they have a high false negative rate. So people will test negative and actually be sick, but most of those people won't actually be contagious. That's part of what they only really test for contagiousness. And in any case, they're so cheap, you can take lots of them. You can still wear a mask. You know, there's ways to deal with their limitations, and in certain ways, their limitations are the point because they're there to test contagiousness, not infectiousness. So it's a great example of the capacity that technology gives us for actually securing normal life if we want to do it. It's a reason why the universe isn't malevolent. It's a way that human beings can use their minds to figure out their way through the problems we encounter.
Yeah, end with a thing here, but maybe it could be a follow-up later on. I'm interested in this prepper movement and how you could prepare before it's coming up with an emergency or something like that. So you could be prepared for the future in different ways. What do you say about that? And also how your intellectual prepare for an emergency or for a situation. So you're mentally prepared, but also how you could prepare in different ways. And as I said, maybe we could have a follow-up on that topic in the future.
Yeah, well, I would...
Sounds good to me.
Without saying too much about the preppers, I'll just say, you know, philosophy is the ultimate preparation for anything. It's what helped you integrate the knowledge you already have to form principles that help you make predictions about the future and to help guide your action.
Great, that's a great way to end it. Thank you very much, Ben, for giving us your time. And we hope to talk to you again in the future.
Great. It was great to be on your show.